This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, and today I have with me in studios Professor Datuk Dr. Asma Ismail, President of Academy of Sciences Malaysia and former Vice Chancellor of University Science Malaysia. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Datuk.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
You have been credited as being a woman of many firsts. You were the first female vice chancellor of both University Science Malaysia and University Science Islam Malaysia, as well as the first female president of ASM. But your tenure at USM ended on a somewhat unusual note. A petition circulated calling for your tenure as a vice chancellor there to be extended. And that gained a lot of traction and made national news, but nothing was done. So could you, first of all, clarify for us the circumstances that surrounded that, what happened behind the scenes?
Okay, at that point in time, being the first woman to be the Director General for Higher Education, I had a lot of experience in terms of what the government wants and what it takes to move the education policy for the country, because I'm also involved in the development of the blueprint for higher education. Mm-hmm. So with that experience, I went back to USM, and I think during my tenure of 3 years, I managed to move USM from 330 in the rank to 165. And Times Higher Education considered it as the highest jump ever shown by a university. So that means I must have created an ecosystem in the university that must be right, that can move things in 3 years. So basically, I thought that, and among other achievements that USM has achieved, that my tenure would have been continued based on merit. As a previous Director General, that is what will be the performance of the Vice Chancellor. But you know, I have retired, and it was on contract for 1 year. And of course, the Vice Chancellor's continuance is always based on the Minister of Higher Education then, which is Dr. Mazli Malik. And he will probably have his priorities if what is considered as a proper vice chancellor of a research university. Mm-hmm. And but the petition was the first. I know there's a lot of firsts attached to my name, and this now the petition became a first as well, because never before you have a petition to ask a vice chancellor to stay. Usually the petition is please remove the vice chancellor. And But let me say that all this is under the bridge, and basically he has his own decisions why he made that decision to not to continue. But life is such that you have to move on with new challenges. And I think that in a way allows me now to be, as President of Academy, to now move the STI landscape in the country. And I think that is where I want to be able now to concentrate and contribute my ability and capability.
So you never spoke with Mazli Malik on the subject?
No. As the previous Director General, I always know that it is always up to the minister to decide. Mm. Yeah.
All right. So now, as President of Academy Science Malaysia for the second term from 2020 to 2022, what are you going to be prioritising during this time?
I think we have come a long way from Academy in 1995, 1994. So basically now, this year is the 25th year anniversary for Academy Science Malaysia. And I think it's about time that we now look at the landscape and look at the gaps that is there in the STEM or STI, Science, Technology, Innovation landscape. And what does it take now to fill up the gap? And there's a lot of gaps that we see now. So we are making our plans and whatnot to now change the STI landscape.
Okay. In terms of your experience as a professor, as a vice chancellor, and as someone who has been steeped in the higher education sphere in STEM subjects, could you give me your take on just the education system? What do you think about it? Because the higher education system particularly has faced a lot of criticism recently over concerns about graduate employability, over high numbers of youth unemployment. So the criticism is that universities are not producing graduates that are able to adapt to the workplace. What's your take on this?
I think at the end of the day, you have to ask the first question, what is the university all about? And the university, basically, to me, is to prepare the minds of the future generation. And that means there's a lot of learning as well as skills that also need to be there. But to measure a university just based on graduate employability, I think it's not quite fair. Because the word graduate employability means to prepare the graduates with the kind of skills needed, critical thinking, ability to communicate in English, and the kind of high-end skills that is now required for the student to now be able to get a job. But the reverse is the perception, which is percentage employment. Percentage employment has got many factors involved. What is the economic situation of the country? So to me, the way they measure graduate employability in university is at the end of December 31st. So basically, and it starts to measure after convocation. So convocation in university is November, and between November to December, there's 1 month. If you have a convocation earlier, mm-hmm. then you have 3 months. If you have a convocation in November, then you have only 1 month. It takes time to get a job. So I think the measurement for graduate employability should be the end of December of the next year. Then you know, rather than the year being questioned. So this, how the graduate employability was measured, I think is very important. So that's what I'm trying to say. I think there is a need to review graduate employability and how you measure it so that it gives you a better reflection of what it's all about. Times Higher Education has also now created impact ranking of university against SDG. That should be something that the university should look into, because it levels the playing field. That even if you are not an MIT or Harvard, whatever, what have you done to create an impact to society? That is now being measured. So this is a new way, and the evolution of how you measure the university is changing. And I think this is a time that it's a matter of the policy. Which one do you want the university to be able to show results rather than just performance? Because performance can just be output. I produce X number of masters, PhD, I produce X numbers of papers. But at the end of the day, what have that university done to benefit the rakyat? So that has always been the question. So, and therefore now, again, why do you go to university? Because you want to get a job. Not that you want to learn. This has now changed the scenario. You want to get a job because paper qualification is now very important. Whether you learn or not, you're not sure. And so now the students are saying, get me the skills, get me what it takes to get a job.
But should the chief purpose of education be to enable graduates to get a job?
Both. To learn and to have the necessary skills to get a job. But right now, it's not just a matter of being employed. It's also a matter of gig economy, that you yourself can now be the starter of the business. So this is the entrepreneurial mindset that we also would like to have. But to be an entrepreneur, to have that entrepreneurial mindset, you also need knowledge, because you are now in an innovation economy where knowledge now is very important. It's not just about the skills alone. Even with skills, it has to combine with knowledge in order for you to leapfrog, to bring the company to the next level. So that means to say, even to bring industries in Malaysia to the next level. This is now a time for knowledge. So that's why I'm saying that it takes both. The university need to equip the graduates with both the knowledge and the skills.
And are they doing a good job of equipping those graduates with those two different sets of skills?
I think university and academia and industry need to sit down, need to work this thing through. Because the way I see it now, as president of academy, now that I'm looking at things differently and no longer from the eye of the academy, I now find that the industry is now saying whatever you are training and teaching is not what we need. Because the industry, in order to be a global player, needs to move now the curriculum to the next level. And unfortunately, we may not even have the lecturers that is equipped with that necessary kind of knowledge. So how do we fill up this gap? So that is why we now need to work in a collaborative network so that we can now have the industry coming in with the curriculum. You need the fundamental math, physics, chemistry, all that biology, you need that fundamental. But you need to move that fundamental now and computer, artificial intelligence to the next level. And artificial intelligence is not just what is the latest state of the art that you need to know. That is what the industry wants. And therefore, I think along the way, we need to fill up this gap with probably what we call technology assemblies or schools that can fill this gap. That is what the industry needs in order to go forward. Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess the concern also when it comes to entering into higher education at this point in the country's development is that education tends to be a lagging indicator. You choose your degree, 3 years later, you enter the job market. Mm. 3 years later can be a long time in terms of technological development. So how well are universities adapting to address that element of the equation?
Well, you know that change is rapidly working so fast that tomorrow's era, the graduates of today, the kind of jobs they're prepared for, that is unknown, right? So therefore, you need to prepare them with what? Flexibility, adaptability, and the kind of basic foundation knowledge. Because after that, they got to put it together, and this is what it takes now to face the unknown. So we have now different kinds of students. Those students who will come in fresh, and the students who are already in the workplace, and they now need to increase their knowledge. So the universities have now to be agile and now be able to cater for a bigger market, not just the fresh graduates, but also people in the job market. And that means now, I know what you're saying, that the public university, things have got to change, because to move the change, it takes too long.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that by the time the student graduate, the information or knowledge is not what is required at the end.
It could be obsolete.
Yes, could be obsolete. So that's why I say now, to cover that, probably we need the industry to now come in and set up their own technology schools to now be able to bring in what is the latest that they would need to upgrade the knowledge of the student so that they are now industry ready.
And on a policy level, is enough being done to nurture scientific learning in Malaysia? What kind of improvements would you like to see coming from a government policy standpoint?
The number of STEM students have declined, not increased. And yet, if you look at the future economy, technology is needed. And behind technology is STEM. So whether you like it or not, we need more engineers. We need people in mathematics. We need people in the critical thinking. So whether we like it or not, there is a need to move STEM education in the schools. But at the end of the day, we are talking about parents. Parents will always say, at the end of the day, does my child get a job? And what is the job there in STEM, for God's sake? You know, is there enough industry? Is there enough things to employ me? But if I put my child in business, yeah, he can get a job. If I put my child in computer science, he can get a job. So,
I think the attraction is the adaptability of the humanities, right? Because if you study a business degree, it doesn't necessarily mean that you only have to go into a business field. You can wind up in a lot of different fields. Management degrees and other humanity degrees
are flexible. But if you study STEM, you can go into any field because the critical thinking is needed. In fact, you go to the banks now, they're hiring STEM students. They're hiring engineers in the banks. Why? Because they need the critical thinking. They can hire the accountants that can do, but even now accountants are being replaced by robots, right? So artificial intelligence can do probably a much better job of it. But this is what I'm saying now, that things have got to change. They have to be agile. And the IPTA, they need to move faster. But we cannot do this alone and in silo. We have to work with the industry to be able now to see what is now relevant and what need to move fast to make the students now being able to be a global player.
I've been speaking with Professor Dr. Asma Ismail, President of Academy of Sciences Malaysia. After this, we'll be talking about her journey as a woman in science in conjunction with the International Day of Women in Science. So be sure to stay tuned for that after these messages. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Professor Dr. Asma Ismail, President of Academy of Sciences Malaysia. Earlier, we were talking about the higher education system and what needs to change. But now I'd just like to focus on you for a bit, Professor, because today is the International Day of Women in Science.
Okay.
And you certainly fulfill that qualification, because you were the first female vice chancellor of USM, University Science Malaysia, and of USIM, University Science Islam Malaysia. You are the first female Director General of Higher Education, first female President of Academy of Sciences Malaysia. You have something like 130 articles and a number of patents to your name.
Yeah,
and you got your training as a molecular biologist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are some who would hold you up as evidence that there isn't a glass ceiling for women in the sciences here in Malaysia. What would you say to that?
Let me put you this way. There is a glass ceiling. Whether you like it or not, there is a glass ceiling. But you got to be a woman of substance. Somewhere along the line, you have to have what I call mentors, godfathers or godmothers, who definitely open the door for you and allow you to have this opportunity. But to open the door, you have to be a woman of substance. It's not just any woman that can buy. So therefore, basically, if you want to move forward, you have to have what it takes first. Then people will see your capability, your ability, and then they start to open the doors. And that in Malaysia is very important, because sometimes it's who you know makes a lot of difference, right, to whether you are now allowed or empowered to show your ability. Otherwise, the glass ceiling still exists. But then again, if people like me and a lot of other women have broken the glass ceiling. So, meaning to say, it can be done. It's not something that...
It's not set in stone.
Yes, yes, not carved in stone.
So how did you go about it?
Basically, in my life, I have I've been very lucky. I have very good bosses who open doors for me, who empower me, and as a result, I am where I am today. But you have to be level-headed in terms of what you do. And you have to be able now to be in a position whereby you're the only woman in the room. But it's very important that people see you as part and parcel of a team. We are much more family-oriented. We make sure that when we run a company or university, all decisions is taken care of. There is a consensus. It's not a matter of I'm dictator, follow my rules, that kind of stuff. So if you see subtly, there is a difference between women as leaders and men as leaders. So that in essence, in the current today, where everybody is a coach, you know what I mean? Like everybody wants to contribute. So you got to be able to get the consensus opinion in order to move forward. That would be a woman's style of leadership.
But as you mentioned the term family-oriented, and family can be almost a setback for a lot of women trying to enter into high-profile, high-pressure fields, because the expectation in a lot of Asian cultures is still that the woman's first priority is to their families and their homes.
Mm.
So how did you navigate that personally?
I have to say one thing. I am an outlier, because I don't have any children. But like I said, I have thousands, 32,000 in University Science Malaysia, another 12,000 at USIM. But what I'm trying to say is that finding the right partner is very important. Because if the partner clip your wings, then there's no way for you to fly and no way for you to show your ability and capability. He should be the wind beneath your wings that will always support. So that's why, if you all have a scientific mind, then, you know, do this rationally, objectively. Of course, there's love can be blind, all that. But bottom line, at the end of the day, to choose the right partner is very important for any movement of a woman forward. Because when you have a family, there is a matter of sharing the responsibility. But if you can do time management well, I've seen women with many children, but proper time management, they can actually deliver what needs to be. But whatever it is, data has shown that we have a leaky pipeline. Even in the universities, when we are being employed, there will be 50% women lecturers, 50% male lecturers. But at the end of the day, there's only about 14 or 15% of women who made it to professorship. So when you have a leaky pipeline, and this is not only in Malaysia, this is throughout the world, where, you know, 44% of women in the world go for PhD, but out of that 44%, only 29% ever make it for professorship. So when you have a low pool of women, there are very few now who even get to the top to be now mentors, to be able to say, aha, I can open the door for you. But for those who made it, it's very important that they have not forgotten to open the doors for women and that they don't see another woman as a threat to them.
So you have spoken publicly as well about the importance of inclusivity and accessibility of education. So when it comes to women in the sciences, what more needs to be done by all the stakeholders involved? So not just the women themselves, but the ministries, the universities, as well as the students and perhaps even the parents of the students.
So let me put it this way. Around the world, very few women are in science. But if you look at statistics for Malaysia, we, as UNESCO put it, we are the world leader in having half of all the scientific researchers in Malaysia are women. More than half of them are women. So we have been called by UNESCO as a world leader in having women in science. But the question that needs to be asked, how many of them are leaders in science? We have many who are research officers and whatnot, but not in the leaders, those who take leadership, principal investigator and stuff. So we need more encouragement in that aspect. But now we find that 70% of women are in the universities. So this is not only for Malaysia, but around the world, we are seeing more and more women are now entering the university. So you're going to see a change in landscape that the future will have more women in all fields. And somewhere along the line, Nature, in a paper, Nature have shown in the studies of 44,000 when they do this unconscious biasness still occur, all right? Despite all the men saying, no, this is not happening, but the Nature paper has shown that when they study about 44,000 workers and if they put male, according to the male or female, you find that lesser women will get the job. But as soon as you change the woman's name to a man's name, 13% of that group of women who was denied the job will now get the job. So this is already showing unconscious biasness does happen. But, you know, that is something that we need to realise and we need to now make that change, especially in terms of policy. But I think the budget speech of 2020 has already addressed last year's budget speech has already addressed to allow now 33,000 jobs for women to return to the workforce, you know. So that is already asking those who are already having a work-life balance, they have to take care of the family, now to come back to the workforce. Because it takes two to tango. If you have only the men filling up the workforce, then you will miss out 50% of the workforce. You have both them together, that will make the country flourish. So this and diversity is very important because different kind of thinking, they have seen that if we put women on the board of companies, they find that companies will move much better than having all just men in the company. And this is data. I'm not talking about hearsay or this what I think. This is all about data that has now shown that the presence of women does make a difference to enhance the performance of the company because the thinking is different, yeah, to add in and make it more holistic.
Thank you so much for speaking with us this morning, Professor. It's been a pleasure having you on The Grill.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. And I like to wish every woman a happy International Day of Women in Science. And let's hope that this is the day that we celebrate our success in science and that those who have made it, this is also the day that we want to be able to hold the hands of those wanting to make it, to help them and inspire them to now move to success.
I've been speaking with Professor Datuk Dr. Asma Ismail, President of Academy of Sciences Malaysia, in conjunction with International Day for Women and Girls in STEM. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.